What up, folks? It's O'Shea Davis with the Working Wonder Podcast Show. And today I got my brother Sean Elizondo with me. He's my POI, person of interest. He has an incredible story to tell everybody, and I'm so grateful that he's willing to tell us about it. If you know about the Working Wonder Podcast Show, it's about discussing our work, our occupation, our world, what we experience, and most importantly, our wonder, what we learn from it all. So with that being said, Sean Elizondo, introduce yourself, brother. Tell them who you are.
Hey, hey, hey. It's Sean here. Thank you so much for having me, man.
Brother, if you don't mind telling a little bit about yourself, telling us where you're from. Is it here in Tulsa? Where are you from?
Yeah. So I was born in McAllen, Texas. Came here with my parents probably whenever I was three or four. Here is Broken Arrow. Went to school mostly in BA. I took a small little break to go to high school in Houston, Texas, and then came back to graduate here in Broken Arrow. But I live here currently with my wife. We've been married 14 years in October. We have two kids, Aiden and Emily, two dogs and two cats.
Sweet, man. Wow. So with that being said, I know a little bit about your backstory. Of course, you work with the fire department with me. That's how we met. And that's how I've learned about Sean, a lot about Sean, and just how great of a guy he is from some of his classmates who told me. And I don't want to butter him up, but I think he knows that a little bit, right? He's invited me to his lovely home, which I'm very grateful for. But so did you grow up with both parents active in your life, or?
So my parents got divorced when I was in fifth grade.
Okay.
I have a brother and sister younger than me. Mm-hmm. I chose to live with my mom, and my brother and sister also lived with my mom for a little bit. And there was an incident that happened, and they ended up moving in with my father, and I stuck around with my mother for the rest of the time until I moved out.
Got you. Okay. And that makes sense. I mean, you kind of chose what you felt was best for you at
right.
that point.
Right.
So I completely understand that. So did your younger siblings look up to you, do you feel like, or you guys were not very close, or what all happened?
I think we started out pretty close. So that incident I was talking about, my mom ended up getting remarried, and I was probably 13 or 14, which would make my brother 10 and my sister 6, probably. Anyways, he went through an abusive stint type situation, and it was just me, my brother, and my sister with this man in our house. And I can't even really remember what set him off, but I know that he got super violent and it happened really quick. And so for me, being 13, 14 years old, I stuffed my brother and sister in the closet, and I kind of just bared the brunt of that entire situation, you know. Mm-hmm. My dad found out about that and obviously took my brother and sister. It was crazy, man. And I think looking back after some reflection, maybe that sparked the whole like career path, profession, like protector, guider type situation. I mean, it wasn't ideal, but I think you had to do what you had to do. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? It's better you than them.
Wow, man. That's I didn't know that about you. And that's the point of this podcast, to learn things about you and other people who maybe experienced that, brother, because you're not the only one that been through that, you know, and the fact that you're willing to open up about that is important. So how long did they stay together while you were there? I mean, after your brother and sister left, you were still there with him, right?
Oh, yeah. The timelines are, you know, shaky a little bit, mm-hmm. but I know as far as that relationship, it didn't last much longer after that.
Got you. Which is good. I'm glad. Oh, yeah. I'm glad it ended. And I hate that you went through that, because I know that had to shape some bitterness in your life. How did it affect your relationship with you and your mom? I mean, did you kind of, were you a little bit upset at her for?
Because of the situation?
Yeah. Well, I didn't think in the moment that I had any like animosity or anything like that. It was just nothing but love. It eventually, flash forward a couple of years, she met another guy, mm-hmm. and that's how we ended up moving to Houston. So I had the opportunity to live with my father, but I felt like I can't let my mom go to a whole other city and state without somebody looking out for her best interest. Mm-hmm. So I switched schools, moved down to Texas, and yeah, that relationship didn't work out either. But it didn't end. It didn't end quite like that. So
gotcha. And you were in high school. When you were in
Houston, Texas.
I was a freshman, I believe, into my sophomore year.
Oh wow. Okay. Okay. So just 1 year in Texas.
Yeah, just 1 year.
Gotcha. And you came back to Oklahoma.
Then, coming back here, lived with her again for a little bit, and then I ended up moving out right after I graduated in 2005.
Gotcha. So at what point? For those who don't know, Sean Elizondo did serve in the military. And what branch? In military, correct?
That's right.
All right. And so how long did you serve in the military?
I served from 2007 to 2013.
Okay, 6 years. Thank you for your service, by the way. We really appreciate it, brother. So that's kind of what brought me to bringing you into it, because that story of survival is so incredible, and just what you experienced and endured for this country, man. I mean, I can't thank you enough, bro. It really does bring tears to my eyes sometimes when you tell me, because I'm like, wow, like, no one should have to go through that. But you did, and God had his hand over you the entire time, you know.
You got that right.
So with that being said, Sean is going to tell a little bit about his story, serving the military. But first I want to say, so what inspired you to join the military? What made you go, this is what I'm going to do?
Yeah, I wish I had, like, an awesome, like, patriotic, I love my country type situation. You know, it evolved into that. I love my country and have tons of pride for it. But it didn't start that way. Honestly, my wife, girlfriend at the time, joined before I did. And she came back after her basic training and her advanced training. And she was ripped, man. She was so in shape. There was something about her, too. Like, the confidence was all there. And I was like, holy cow. Like, look at this woman. And then look at me. Like, I was stalled out. I was a waiter at the time, not really doing nothing, kind of fudging my way through college, you know, like, just kind of faking it. Mm-hmm. And I saw her. I was like, that's what I want, you know. And so I joined, you know, and I guess the rest is history.
That's awesome. So your wife inspired you to make the move because you saw how she was evolving. That's awesome, man. And that's nothing wrong with that at all. I think that's exactly how great marriages and great relationships are formed. One person sees the other person maybe doing a little bit or doing more or advancing themselves in some way. And you're like, I want to be like that too. I want to match your energy. I want to match what you're doing. So that's awesome, brother. So, and at that point, did you serve? How did it work for you? Because you guys didn't have any kids together yet or anything like that?
No.
Okay. So since she was in the military, and now you wanted to join the military, did you end up at the same base, or you end up at a different base, or what happened there?
So she joined the Army Reserves.
Army Reserve.
I ended up going active duty.
Okay.
So while I was in basic training and doing my advanced training, she was back in Houston, actually. And then once I graduated and landed in a place, I landed in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, in the 82nd Airborne Division, we were married at that time. We got married right before I got in.
Gotcha.
In 2007. So she was able to come with me at Fort Bragg, and then that's where we kind of started our family. And, yeah, so we were able to be there together.
All right. So with that being said, brother, I understand that you said you served two tours in Iraq. Why don't you explain that situation, and what was some of the easiest moments, I hate to say easiest, but some of the moments that you felt like everything's all right, you know, I'm safe, I'm good, and some of the scariest moments, some of the tough moments that you experienced.
So I served in Iraq from 2009, 2010 with the 82nd Airborne. And again, when I switched units after that deployment to airborne unit in Alaska, and we went to Afghanistan. So one tour in Iraq for a full year, and then another in Afghanistan. But going back to your question, the easiest part probably in Iraq was we were so trained. You know, we were ready. We practiced and we drilled, and I mean that's all we did every day. That's our full time job, was to train and be ready. So that one, everyone's Iraq deployment are different. You know, everyone's stories are different. My Iraq deployment was relatively easy. Nothing crazy happened on that one. Afghanistan, that was a little bit different story. Hardest part for Iraq for me was being away from family. Ashley and I had a brand new baby at that time, and she was away from family. She didn't come home. She stayed in North Carolina. So she did all that mom stuff on our own, and the only way we could communicate was Skype every once in a while. So that by far was the hardest part of that deployment.
I can definitely see that being difficult for a new mom, because it was your first child, correct?
Yes.
So first child, and here she is, and you're deployed in Iraq, correct? So, yeah, oh, man, that would be hard. You feel like you're missing out these moments with this child and all the other things to come with it. But what about your second tour in Afghanistan?
My squad and I were involved in an improvised explosive device while we were returning off from mission on April 3rd, 2012. I think it's important to talk about a little bit the mission before the actual IED, because ultimately it led to the capture of the insurgents. So our mission that day was to, we had a small little village, we cordoned it, we gathered all the military age males and put them in a line, and we took their retina scan and all their fingerprints. So it took all day long, and I was trying to put myself in their shoes. Like, how would I feel if somebody gathered me up and took a picture of my eyeball and stuff like that, you know? So you've got to try to be gentle and not being really accusing, but like, hey, this is just for information storage type situation. Mm-hmm. But so flash forward, we're leaving that mission, and on the way back, and you know, we picked the wrong path, and there ended up being a significant IED on the side of the road. Radio debt. So somebody was watching, saw the trucks hit their little target zone, and hit the button. It was just crazy, man. It killed my driver instantly. Jeff White, he was 19, from St. Louis. The way that bomb was designed was crazy. So these trucks that were in, they're minimum 43,000 pounds, 10 feet tall, built actually to withstand bombs, because by this point in the war, we know that that's their MO. You know, like, that's what they're doing. They're blowing us up. So these trucks are designed with the hull of a boat, kind of, where it's pointed, it's V'd out so that all the explosives can kind of just go away, as opposed to, like, impacting the inside of the truck. Even with that, the bomb was so significant that it blew a hole underneath Jeff's seat, and it had a secondary incendiary device that lit the entire cab on fire. Like, when I'm not just saying, like, a little barbecue campfire, like, this was insane. It was insane. So I remember, for example, there's like this little plastic cylindrical handle on my side of the door, and you push it in, and it engages the air compressor to help open the door, because those doors alone are, you know, 1,000 pounds. It's heavy. So you need that help, that mechanical pressure or whatever to help open it. Anyways, this solid plastic piece, it got so hot so fast that there's a scar on my hand that is just seared in.
Wow.
I don't know. It was just super hot, super fast.
Wow.
So anyways, I wasn't wearing my seatbelt, and I think that might have been like the make or break point for me. It's just one less thing, one less obstacle that I had to like really worry about, because when I came back to, I'm in an inferno, right? And I didn't really know what to do. I tried to get out from my door, and my door wasn't working. My only option was to crawl back towards the flame, towards Jeff, over the radio, and up and out of the gunner's hatch. And so I did that. We started getting guys out, because we had other people in the back as well.
What was your thought process on that? I got to ask that, man. How did you possibly collect the thought to say, I need to get out, I know exactly how to get out? How did you do you remember how you processed that? Was it, do you feel like something was taken over for you? Or did you just kind of know, because you trained so much that you knew how to get out?
I think it was a combo. That fight or flight stuff, that's real, you know?
Yeah.
And we did this funny training. Everyone thought it was such a big waste of time. When you get into the combat zone, you kind of do this rollover simulator, you know? So they put you in a mock truck, and you get strapped in, and they roll you, like, halfway, then they roll you all the way, and you're supposed to be able to get out, like, unbuckle yourself, find your exit, and come out. And everyone thought it was so easy, and it was kind of like pointless, you know what I mean? It's just check the box kind of deal.
Uh-huh.
And I can't help but think that, I mean, you know what I mean? It had something to do with being able to, like, orient myself in the truck and know, like, look, my door's not open. I know that there's an exit behind me type situation.
Wow.
Like, so, But I don't remember exactly. I just know that everything was happening fast, mm-hmm. and I knew that I was in a very bad situation.
But I didn't mean to interrupt, brother. I just had to ask that. So going on with the story. So you were saying you were climbing out of the hatch and.
Yeah. So the bomb was big enough to propel this truck forward. So picture just a huge blast area where they had buried the bomb, and then the blast propelled it forward. So I didn't know that. But I'm on top of the truck, and it's a 10-foot-tall vehicle, and I had to get down. So I jumped down, but I didn't know that I was jumping into the explosion hole. So 10 feet to the ground, and then add another 5 feet. So I jumped 15 feet down to the ground, messed my knee up at that point, which is the least of my worries. I had significant burns. I remember hobbling to cover to the next, I was lead vehicle in that convoy. And I remember hobbling back to cover in the next vehicle and asking about the crew, you know, cause I had other guys in there. And my medic was just like, we need to worry about you right now for, you know what I mean? And yeah, there wasn't a lot you can do in that situation for the kinds of burns that I had. And I can't remember exactly how long it took, but I know the next thing that is happening, well, these guys are doing their business. They're securing the area, like probably have 5 trucks, and they're all doing their part, you know, trying to do a counter. Anyways, the next thing I know, I'm in a helicopter headed to a medical facility somewhere in Afghanistan.
Well, man, I can't thank you enough for just telling your story about that, because that's such a traumatic experience. And at the same time, you know, I think that God, in a strange way, was preparing you for something extraordinary. And you didn't know it at the time, but he had, like I mentioned before, he had his hand on you. And once you came out, and like you said, you were at the hospital, did you know what happened? Were you aware, or were you completely disoriented and lost? What happened then?
So I knew what happened. I know I was in shock. I just couldn't process the level of trauma that I was facing. I couldn't process the fact that I didn't know that my driver Jeff had died. I mean, I just didn't know. But I remember the helicopter landed into like this medical facility in Afghanistan, and there's a row of army nurses and doctors to greet me. And I get wheeled into this little outpost hospital surgery room situation, and from there I remember them trying to put me under. I had smoke inhalation burns, things of that nature, so they wanted to make sure that I was stable. This is one crazy part I wanted to mention. So they put me under, and I'm supposed to be completely not conscious, not being able to feel, like completely under anesthesia, but I was awake. You know what I mean? Like I was paralyzed and my eyes were closed, but inside I was there. Like, wow. I remember like screaming, I'm yelling, in my mind I'm kicking. I'm like, I'm still here. I can hear you talking. And the nurses, they say to each other, is he supposed to be twitching like that? And the other nurse goes, no. And they make it a minor adjustment, lights out.
Wow.
But I was there, man. I was fully aware of the room, but my body was just paralyzed.
Wow.
It was weird.
That is weird.
It was weird.
I mean, that's weird. It's almost like you ever had sleep paralysis? Whenever you go, it's like you're asleep or you're awake. And you can't move, and you're like, I hear stuff. I know I'm awake.
Yeah.
I know. So I get that sometimes if I'm like really sleepy and I'm trying to take a quick nap, mm-hmm. and I can hear the room, but I can't move. Because I'm asleep,
right.
You know, so it may be somewhat similar to that. Of course, a lot scarier, because given the situation, you're like, what in the world is happening right now? So, but moving on there, I remember one of the things that you told me back when I worked with you at your station, and you were saying how at one point you were actually afraid of fire. And I think it's crazy, because now you're literally a firefighter. I mean, you've overcame so much in that moment. And to have that fear of being burned and deciding a job where you have to go back into the fire, what gave you the courage and the strength to want to do that?
It's hard to put my finger exactly on what it was, but something inside doesn't really like to be afraid. My view was the only way to overcome it is to just tackle it head on. That coupled with the fact that I've had, after I got out of the military, there was a couple of jobs I just wasn't completely satisfied with. Super unfulfilling. I felt the calling to be part of something bigger than myself again, like I used to be. You know, I was somebody. I felt important. I felt like I was contributing, and I needed to find a place to do that. So I was able to get on the Tulsa Fire Department and tackle my fear and fulfill my purpose in the exact same time.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing, man. Most people stay afraid of what they're afraid of for the rest of their life. People have phobias and they're 80 years old. They never overcome it. And just being able to overcome it and make a career out of it, you're a warrior, bro. You're a warrior. You really are, man. So moving on with that, too, one of the questions I just had to ask, just because it's kind of a tough question, but I think that you may have experienced it, but did you ever have any survivor's guilt?
It's a good question, and it's real, and it's probably the thing that I struggle with most currently. So this incident happened like 9 years ago in April, and time does heal a lot of the wounds, but there are some things that are just super hard to get over. So in this example, I was tasked with being a leader. I'm squad leader. I'm in charge of 8 guys. You have one responsibility when you take guys into combat, and that's to bring them home to their families. Mm-hmm. I failed. Right. So as a first squad leader, my main responsibility when it comes to missions was route planning. So the night before, route plan to and from contingencies, and then I brief the platoon leader and get the thumbs up or thumbs down. But it's my call. It's my responsibility. And I picked that route that we went on that day, and it was the wrong one. So to answer your question, the answer is yes. Some days are better than others, and everyone that I've talked to, my wife especially, assures me that it's not my fault. But I can hear that until the cows come home. But there's something in deep, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I can't explain it, and it may never go away.
Yeah, well, man, like you said, no one can tell you otherwise because you're such a good-hearted person that you're taught in the military to take ownership. And I'm sure you're familiar with Jocko Willink and extreme ownership and just being a leader. And there is things that just no matter how good, you know, you would have made a better decision and went back, something else might have happened. Maybe even worse. Maybe it would have been everybody, no one back to tell anybody's story, you know. So it's just hard to say in that situation, but I definitely give you the credit to know that you are taking ownership as a leader, but also be aware that no matter what we think we could have done, it's always something else that would have probably happened, you know. And it's a lot of just what if, could have, should have type of situations. So, but for overall, I mean, I can't imagine. I never experienced something any close to that, so I can't even. But that's why I'm grateful that we're having this conversation. To be able to honor you and honor those who have fallen with the idea in mind to protect, serve, and contribute to this country in some fashion. So that's amazing, man. If you don't do anything else after this podcast, every time you see a veteran, anybody, you should definitely thank them for their service and just be grateful because not everybody has the heart and courage to do that. They don't. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if I would have ever considered joining the fire service if it wasn't something in me that realized that I'm willing to give my body, my mind, and my heart to the citizens of Tulsa. Right. You know, and it takes something special to want to do it, right? So it's very important, brother. But moving on from there, one of the last things I like to wrap up here, so we talked about family and service, but now we're going to talk about recovery because that's an important part. Like you mentioned, you're still facing some of those things. And I want to say, what do you think for you kept you going at times when you felt weak, depressed, upset, angry, aggravated, all those emotions that you felt? What kept you pushing and kept you moving forward?
Which I'll say that I felt all those things. a lot, you know, a lot. Yeah. It's been a long road, and I think that it's still, I'm still on that road. But I do believe that everything happens for a reason, and there was a reason why God saved me, you know? And what kept me going is I don't want to squander that opportunity. Why? I mean, I need to do everything I possibly can to make sure that my life is going in the right direction. You know, I just don't want to waste that second opportunity. That coupled with I have children who look up to me now. I have a spouse that depends on me for emotional support. And I can't be the guy that just sits in my pity and my sorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, I had to break through. And I think I just kept moving forward, and that's the only thing. So,
and that definitely comes back to family support, because I know with your wife being in the service, she had some understanding of the stress that you may have endured, and being there for you, and you guys staying strong through that is so important, man, because we all know that divorce happens a lot in the military. Right. It does. And for you guys to stay together, stick through it, kudos to you guys for sure. You know, and that just shows how much you're willing to make it work. Because I imagine that it was times when this had a stress on your marriage.
Oh, 100%. And the only reason Sean is sitting here in front of you today, the Sean that I am, is because of my spouse. She's super strong. She's supportive, patient. She was my caregiver physically, dressing my wounds for an entire year, making sure that I didn't miss appointments, make sure I had all my medication. If there's anyone that needs the credit, it's her.
Shout out to the wife. What's her name again?
Ashley.
Shout out to Ashley.
You're so beautiful. I love you.
Shout out to Ashley for holding it down, man. That's so important. And us as husbands, we need that support, just like our spouse needs that support from us, man. It's such a team effort here. We got to work. And I tell my wife that sometimes, where, you know, when I feel weak, I need you to be strong. And when you feel weak, I'm supposed to be strong. And that's how we balance each other out. That's how we work as a team. You know, I got to be Kobe. You got to be Shaq sometimes. You know what I mean? Maybe you got to make it to the hole and take a dunk. Maybe I got to shoot a three. You know, and that's kind of – or if you want to take it back to Jordan and Pippen, you know. So whatever classic team and duo you want to think of, it takes those two to make the dream work. Absolutely. But last but not least, just to wrap things up, brother, what is one last final thing – it could be a phrase, it could be a story, it could be a quote — that you would give to our listeners?
I would say probably the same thing that I would tell my children, is that one moment, one event doesn't define you. It's really just a chapter in your book. And the next chapter is in your hands. You know, you can continue on this path. You can go anywhere you want. Humans in general are resilient, but you ultimately control the cards, right? You can do it. Whatever.
You have influence and control of your life, and realize that one moment does not define you. That is words of Sean Elizondo. So grateful for to have this brother on the Working Wonder podcast show. Thank you for allowing me in your home. And if there's anything I can do for you, brother, let me know, please. All right? Thank you so much. All right. Yeah, appreciate you, brother.